agent since her days at university, Sam had been there to guide and look out for her. Sam was regaining consciousness and starting to move.
Stay still, Sam. You'll be fine. Just keep still until the paramedics get here.
Sam groaned.
Laura, keep talking to him. I need him to stay still because of this bleeding.
She stroked her mentor's hair.
It's all right, Sam, we're here. Just lie still. The ambulance is on its way.
Marie? Gary? Called Jackman. Any idea where the shot came from?
Negative,
Gary called back.
Too dark to see,
added Marie.
Just stay down. Don't forget, he's a patient man. It could be you he really wants.
I think he's done exactly what he wanted to do, sir. He'll be long gone.
Marie sounded angry.
How's Sam?
I'll be a good deal happier when the ambulance gets here.
It was odd that no one else had seen what happened, but he supposed they were off the main road and the restaurant was busy.
At last.
Blue lights flashed from the end of the street, which was suddenly filled with people, noise, activity. Uniformed officers from Greenborough Station were first on the scene, closely followed by two paramedics. Jackman had never been so pleased to see an ambulance in his whole life. Even though he was inclined to agree with Marie that Ashcroft was already miles away, he was still wary. He was especially concerned for Laura and Marie. Their old adversary could easily bide his time, then strike again. Jackman handed the scene over to the Greenborough officers, who set about cordoning it off. Laura found him and took his hand.
Sam's stable, but they are blue-lighting him to A&E. The medics told me the bullet has nicked the brachial artery, which is why he was bleeding so profusely. They need to get it sorted very quickly, or...
Her voice shook.
Regaining control, she said, "Luckily the hospital is only minutes away. I'll follow them there."
"Of course. I'll come with you."
He looked around for Gary and Marie and found them talking to the Greenborough crew.
"Could I ask if one of you would drive my car back to the Nick and leave it there for me?" he said. "I'll go to the hospital with Laura, and we'll take her car home."
"No problem, boss," said Marie, taking his keys from him.
She sighed, looking around her, evidently still searching the dark buildings and black windows for signs of a gun barrel.
"I hope Sam is okay. Tell him we're thinking of him."
He nodded.
"Of course I will."
Gary took Marie's arm.
"Come on, Sarge. Nothing more for us here."
Jackman turned away. Yet again, that bastard Ashcroft had managed to ruin something beautiful. The man was like a cancer. A malignant evil, stealing beauty and replacing it with something vile. This had to end soon, or Ashcroft would destroy them all.
He wanted to howl in frustration. "Just let him make one mistake," he said to himself. "One tiny mistake."
Not far away, another man echoed Jackman's howl. That too was silent, sealed off by the gag around Paul Lorimer's mouth. Even though he knew it was hopeless, he strained against the ropes that held him fast to the chair. How could he have been such a fool? Believing he was hunting down the imposter, he had charged into the lion's den, straight into a trap. He'd often been to the camper van and chatted with the man he believed to be Ezra over a coffee or a beer. On one occasion, he had noticed some letters lying on the table addressed to Ezra at 7 Abbey Lane, Salton Le Fen. But didn't Ezra live near Hull? Puzzled, he made a note of the address. So when the false Ezra disappeared, Paul had a good idea where to look for him. He even knew how he had made his escape. About a week before it all happened, he'd seen a motorcycle concealed beneath an old tarpaulin in one of the old outbuildings that they never used. He had recognized it as belonging to a bloke who lived in neighboring Thatcher's Fen. He'd worked on the engine a couple of times to earn a few extra pounds for Ma's pot. At the time, he believed that one of his brothers had stolen it, and reluctant to bring Ma's wrath down on their heads, he held his peace and waited to see what would happen. He had found it earlier that evening, concealed in the back garden of 7 Abbey Lane. He went to take a closer look. At that moment, a sack was pulled roughly over his head and something struck him squarely on the back of his skull. Now, he was a prisoner. Paul's anger turned to worry and then to fear.
Why was this man keeping him a prisoner? What did he have planned for him? A tear slid silently from his eye. Some hero he'd turned out to be. Rachel Lorimer listened to what Jacob had to say, and then sent the two boys back to their caravan. She had been remarkably calm with them. Paul, with a gun, and that vile temper of his, not a good combination. Rachel weighed up her options, of which there appeared to be three. It was late, and there was a very good chance that Paul wouldn't find the imposter anyway. So, option one was that she could just wait for him to come slinking back, tail between his legs, and confront him then about the weapon. Number two was that she could go and look for him herself. But Levi and Gillian were already combing the streets for a sighting of his car. If they found him, they would be sure to bring him home immediately. That left option three. Phone Marie Evans. And if she chose the last one, what then? Paul would be hunted down by an armed unit. Frightened, stupid, and with a temper that flared up out of nowhere, Paul could end up dead, shot by a police marksman. Things were bad enough for her already without losing her son. Rachel sank down at the kitchen table and put her head in her hands. She felt very old. How on earth had Paul got hold of a gun? And a handgun at that. She could only think it had something to do with the men and women he sometimes worked with on the farms. Most of the migrants were hard-working people, but there was a small core of hardened criminals among them. Maybe one of those had asked Paul to hide a weapon for them. Rachel shook her head. The kids had always been a trial, but now they were grown. She no longer knew how to deal with them. There was no one to turn to anymore. There would be no more letters from Ezra, no more cards, and no one to share her problems with. Rachel Lorimer was on her own, struggling with a family that was fast getting out of control, all because of one man. Someone she didn't even know. Finally, Rachel stood up and went to the telephone. Chapter 28. Alistair Ashcroft smiled down at the young man, whose face was scarlet with rage and the effort of struggling against his bonds. He shook his head. "Look, Paul, I understand why you're so angry with me, but you have to see things my way." The look he received was murderous. However, Ashcroft was a patient man, so he dragged another chair across the room and sat facing Paul Lorimer. "The first thing you should know is that you have been lied to by the police. They have told you a whole pack of untruths about me, and because we were friends once, I want you to know the real truth." He leaned forward, all sincerity. "The most important thing for you to know is that Ezra and I were close. I loved him like a brother, and I did not kill him." Paul was still struggling, but more feebly now. "Sit still, boy, and listen. If you stay calm and quiet, I'll remove the gag. And if you listen and let me tell you what really happened, I'll untie you and let you go. Deal? What do you have to lose just by listening? Nothing, right? Think about it, Paul. I didn't have to stay here, did I? I could have gone anywhere, back to where I came from, but I didn't." He laughed softly. "I left those letters for you to see. They say you're not very bright, but I disagree. You've proved me right by finding me when half the police force couldn't do so. That's why I knew I could trust you to help me." He looked at Paul and raised his eyebrows. "So, can I remove the gag?" He waited. Paul nodded. Ashcroft moved around to the back of the chair and loosened the gag, which slipped down around the boy's neck. "Better?" Paul coughed, then muttered something. The main thing was that he didn't scream. Ashcroft returned to his chair. "You must have realized you were my favorite. Your brothers are great, but I always thought you were special. I'm sorry I lied to get you to help me, like with the gun, for instance, but I didn't dare tell the truth. Imagine if I'd told poor Jacob. It would have been a disaster. You are the only one I can really trust.
Who are you?
Croaked Paul. My name is Ralph Renwick, and Ezra was very dear to me. But, he looked sadly at Paul, he got himself involved in some very dodgy deals back in Hull. I tried to warn him, but by then he was in too deep. He upset some seriously nasty people, and he feared for his life. Sadly, he was right to do so.
So they killed him, not you?
They did, Paul. Paul looked unconvinced.
But why did you come here? Why pretend to be Ezra?
Well, to keep it short, Ezra told me all about your family and how much he cared about you all. He also said you weren't managing very well and that he was worried for your safety. The man he was frightened of lived in Sultan Lefen and knew where you lived. I wanted to protect you, but also find the man who killed Ezra. That's why I needed the gun that you and Levi stole from me. He allowed Paul to digest this information. And I'm very sorry I had to hit you earlier, but you would never have listened if I just tried to talk to you, isn't that right? Paul shook his head.
I wanted to kill you.
I know, son. But now you have the truth, and I'm glad. I know you struggle with your temper, Paul, but you are far brighter than the others. I know you will understand that what I'm telling you makes sense. For Ezra's sake, I need to find that man before he gets to your ma and the rest of the family.
But why did you have to kill all those other people? I don't understand.
You think I killed them? Ashcroft looked suitably horrified.
Ezra's killer must have been watching. He stole that gun from me, Paul. After all your efforts, I never even had the chance to use it.
So, you were innocent?
Of everything. Apart from deceiving you boys. And I only did that to help you in the long run. Oh, Paul, I do so wish I had been the real Ezra. I felt so at home with you all. I mean, I treated you well, didn't I? Bought you food and drink? Be fair. Would I have done that if I didn't care for you?
I guess not.
That was all he wanted to hear. The bait had been taken.
Then I'll untie you. We'll have a drink together, and I'll answer all your questions, okay?
Nodding, Paul gave a wan smile. Alistair Ashcroft smiled back at him.
Then I need a favour from you, if you're willing. If you do this for me, you will earn yourself and your ma more money than you've ever seen.
He took out a wallet and opened it.
This is just a little down payment.
He peeled off 6 50-pound notes and pushed them into Paul's pocket.
You'll get the rest later.
And it's money for nothing, trust me. He had watched the boy's eyes glint as he took out the money and knew it had clinched the deal. He untied Paul and gently massaged his wrists and ankles.
Okay, my friend, you are now my second in command. We have a reconnaissance operation to carry out. But,
he gave Paul a knowing wink,
they say an army marches on its stomach, so we'll eat first. Then we need to do something about your appearance if we are to move around unnoticed.
But the town is full of police and
half of them are looking for you, and the rest are looking for me.
Ashcroft gave a contemptuous laugh.
Fear not, young soldier. For one thing, we are not going into town, and with a couple of simple additions to your clothes, you will be able to walk right past them, believe me.
His laughter faded.
I want to thank you, Paul, for helping me. As far as I'm concerned, catching the man who killed your uncle, my dearest friend, is the most important thing in the whole world, and the only way I can do it is to convince that Detective Jackman of my innocence. You understand, don't you?
Paul looked at him gravely.
Yes, Ralph. I understand now. Just tell me what I have to do.
Marie and Gary finally got home, after what Gary called a night to remember. Marie was just endeavouring to shut the car door quietly when her mobile rang. What now? It was late, and a call at this hour did not bode well. She prayed it was not bad news about Sam Page. Cursing softly,
She took her phone from her pocket and stared at the display. Unknown number. Tentatively, she answered.
Marie Evans? I need your help.
Rachel? What's wrong?
It's Paul, Marie. He's gone looking for the man who impersonated my Ezra. He said he was going to kill him.
Marie knew what it must have taken for Rachel Lorimer to pick up that phone.
Listen, Rachel, I'm really pleased that you rang me, but don't worry yourself too much. We have half the Fenland Constabulary out looking for that man, and if we can't find him, how will Paul?
Unless he knows something that we don't.
I know that, but just... if he did find him, there's something you really need to know.
Rachel Lorimer paused. Marie waited.
He has a gun.
Marie closed her eyes. Had Salt on the Fen suddenly turned into bloody Dodge City? Did everyone tote a gun nowadays?
Do you mean his air rifle?
She recalled that all bar one of the Lorimers used them to keep the rats down.
No, Jacob saw it. He said it was a pistol.
Where on earth?
I don't know. I'm just scared for him, and I don't want you lot shooting him either.
Rachel sounded almost hysterical, which was unlike her.
Calm down, Rachel. We won't shoot him.
Unless he does something really stupid.
But, and this is important, does Paul know where this man might be?
I don't think so. I mean, why would he?
Maybe he gave him an indication when he was acting as Ezra?
I doubt it. And you know my kids, Marie. You don't drop hints to them. Not one of them will catch on.
She paused for a moment, then added,
I sent my Levi and Gillian to Salton to look for him and bring him home.
What to say? Marie certainly didn't want to give Rachel the unvarnished truth, that the streets were alive with police officers, some heavily armed, all hyped up and looking for Ashcroft. The tension out there was palpable. Nerves were stretched to their limit. It was not a good place to wander around at night, especially carrying a gun.
Look, I know you have to do whatever you have to do, Marie, but he's not a bad boy. He's just angry and hurt. If you can, please help him.
Of course I will. I'll do everything in my power. Now, does either Levi or Gillian have a mobile phone? Can you contact them and ask them to come home? They would be safer with you.
We can't afford them mobile things. We don't have nice fat police salaries like you, Marie Evans.
Sorry, Rachel, I didn't think.
Rachel Lorimer didn't deign to respond.
I just want my kids back safe.
I'm going to ring the duty sergeant right now, Rachel, and ask him to tell his guys to look out for Levi and Gillian.
Good. And Paul?
The same goes for him. Let's just hope he doesn't wave that gun around. I'll tell Uniform that he's not a threat, but to be careful not to frighten him. It's the best I can do.
That's all I can ask.
There was a rustling of paper.
Now, here's Levi and Paul's car numbers. Levi has an old Vauxhall and Paul drives a Renault.
Marie wrote down the license numbers, make and colour of the cars. It wasn't a big town, and with so many people keeping off the streets, Uniform should find them without too much trouble. It was Paul's reaction, if approached, that worried Marie.
I've got your number. I'll ring you if I have any news. And, Rachel, you call me if any or all of them come home, no matter what the time, okay?
Marie ended the call and hurried inside the house. Gary was boiling the kettle for a cup of tea.
I don't even want to ask what that was about.
Marie raised her eyes to the ceiling.
Oh, nothing much. Paul Lorimer has turned into Roy Rogers and has gone after Ashcroft with a pistol.
Levi's organised a posse to fetch him back, and his ma wants us to find them all and send them home.
That family.
She shook her head. But I'll have to ring the station and report it. I can see the headlines now. Police gun down poor deprived kid with learning difficulties. The public will love it.
Are you going to tell Jackman?
Asked Gary, taking milk from the fridge.
I have to. And I'll get the latest on Sam at the same time.
Her expression darkened.
That gunshot is still ringing in my ears. How about you?
I'm trying not to think about it. It was such a good evening up until then. I was totally relaxed. Then, bang!
He shuddered.
I can say it now, Marie. I was scared. Really scared.
You weren't alone, Gary. I was shitting myself. Ashcroft promised to take me out one day, and I thought that day had come.
Gary handed her a mug of tea.
Make your calls before we frighten the life out of each other.
Marie smiled at him.
Thanks for being here, Gary. I think I might have fallen apart if I were on my own. At least we can buoy each other up, can't we?
He grinned at her.
That's what mates are for, and it works both ways. I may be a man, but that doesn't mean I don't need a bit of support.
He pointed to the phone.
Ring it in, before Wyatt Earp Jr. starts cleaning up the town.
Sam Page was being assessed prior to surgery, and Jackman and Laura had been asked to wait outside. Jackman had got them coffee, which tasted even worse than the stuff the station provided. Despite his attempts to persuade her to go home, Laura had insisted on staying.
It's all my fault, Rowan. I should never have got him involved. I knew how dangerous Ashcroft was, and yet I still asked Sam to come and stay with me after the apartment was broken into.
Jackman had never seen her so distressed.
Sam was aware of the danger, he said gently. And he came to you, didn't he? You didn't force him. I reckon he'd have been pretty hurt if you hadn't turned to him, don't you think?
Laura didn't reply.
If anyone's to blame, it's me, Jackman said. I let my guard down tonight, and no one should know better than me that you never do that with Ashcroft on the loose. Just because we were out of Salton, I allowed myself to believe that we were safe for a few hours. I just wanted everyone to take a breather and enjoy themselves, remind them that there's a life away from mayhem and murder.
Laura took his hand.
There's really only one person to blame, isn't there? It's not your fault, and nor is it mine.
The main thing is that Sam is still alive.
That still puzzled him. Why was Sam not dead? Unlike Christopher, Barney, William, and Ernie.
Thank the Lord, whispered Laura. He's been like a father to me over the years, always there to talk me through the tough cases or just to discuss interesting ones. I'm not sure what I would have done if he had been killed.
Jackman wondered that too. When they had talked about families in the past, Laura had always steered the conversation away from herself. It had soon become clear that it was a subject to avoid.
What happened to your real father? Don't tell me if you'd rather not.
He died, she said simply. Far too young.
Not wanting to push her, Jackman assumed it must have been cancer or something like that.
That's rough on a kid, he said softly.
He went to work one day. He was a consultant psychologist too, you know. And he never came home.
It's all right, darling. You don't need to say any more.
I was always going to tell you one day, Laura said softly. It's no secret. It just hurts, so I try not to think about it. You see, a patient he was treating pushed him out of a window, and he fell to his death. He was 38.
Jackman closed his eyes.
I am so sorry.
That's why I became a psychologist too, to continue his work, caring for the damaged people that need help so badly. A few years later, Mum married again and moved abroad. I never really took to my stepfather, so I was pretty much on my own after it happened.
Jackman didn't know what to say. He'd often wondered how people coped with such situations, when someone close to you is suddenly erased. And of course it had happened to his brother James. When his beautiful wife went out one day and didn't return, James had fallen apart. Laura squeezed his hand.
It's all right, honestly, I should have told you ages ago.
Before he could respond, a nurse beckoned to them.
You can go back in for a while, but we will be prepping him for theatre shortly.
Sam was conscious but heavily sedated. Even so, he smiled when he saw Laura.
Sleepy, he murmured. Very sleepy.
How's the pain, Sam? Asked Jackman.
Pain?
Ah, they've given you some of the strong stuff, then.
Feel wonderful,
burbled Sam, and closed his eyes. The nurse checked the monitors.
I suggest you go and get some rest now. He's booked for theatre quite soon, and afterwards he'll be taken to intensive care. The bullet damaged the brachial artery, and we have a vascular surgeon coming in to operate on him. It's a complicated procedure, and we'll need to monitor his heart very carefully, as he's had cardiac problems in the past.
I'd rather stay, said Laura.
I'm afraid you won't be able to see him, probably, until tomorrow lunchtime at the earliest. You can leave your number and we'll ring you should there be any cause for concern.
Jackman put his arm around her. You need some sleep, Laura. And so do I. He's in safe hands. Laura hesitated, then nodded.
You're right. But I'll drop you off at the station early in the morning and come straight back here.
He was happy with that. He was also happy that a number of uniformed officers were in attendance at the hospital. Sam would not be left alone anywhere the public had access. He didn't think Ashcroft would be back, but they were taking no chances. As they drove home, Laura suddenly said,
Ashcroft never intended to kill him, did he? It was a message for you.
She laid her hand on his leg.
Sam's wound is in the identical spot where he shot you.
He nodded. Except I was lucky. It was a smaller caliber bullet, and it missed the artery. So he had been right to wonder. Ashcroft never missed his mark, and he hadn't this time either. As Laura said, he was just reminding Jackman what he was capable of. Chapter 29 Uniform located Levi and Gillian at around 1 a.m. and sent them straight back to Hawker's Fen. They had no luck with Paul or his car, and by morning Rachel Lorimer was not the only one to be worried. Jackman tried not to imagine the worst, but it wasn't easy. Paul Lorimer was a vulnerable adult. He'd always been a loose cannon, always had a short fuse, and now he was carrying a lethal weapon. Jackman was in the office waiting for Ruth Crook to arrive so that he could give her a report on the previous night's events. Laura had told him that Sam had pulled through the operation and was being closely monitored. It was a huge relief, but he worried about Laura being at the hospital on her own. Unbeknownst to her, he had contacted D.I. Nikki Galina and explained the situation. Nikki had immediately made sure that her uniforms on duty at Greenborough Hospital were watching Laura as well as Sam Page. The knowledge made Jackman feel a little easier. During the original investigation, and before he and Marie were injured, Jackman had felt some compassion for the terribly damaged little boy who had become a psychotic killer. Now, all that he felt was frustration and the urgency of stopping him. All empathy had gone. Jackman noticed that he was having deeply emotional thoughts and was sometimes overwhelmed by his fear for his colleagues and the dreadful burden of responsibility for their safety. Then there were the recurring flashbacks from that nightmare. Trying to staunch the bleeding from Sam's gunshot wound was traumatic enough, without having to contend with the notion that he was actually working on Marie. Jackman checked his watch. Ruth would be here soon. That bloody nightmare. Why hadn't it faded by now? In fact, it seemed to return with increasing force every time it came into his mind. He kept telling himself it was just a bad dream. They did sometimes stay with you. Indeed, he could still recall some of his dreams from childhood, both good and bad. He knew it was no portent of doom. Jackman was far too hard-boiled for that kind of rubbish. But he wanted it gone. Every time it came back, it stole his reason just for a few seconds, but those seconds could be vital if he needed to deal with some emergency. With a vicious swing of his forearm, Jackman swept the reports from his desk. Not content with disrupting his waking life, Ashcroft had even invaded his sodding dreams. Releasing his anger seemed to have helped. As he knelt and gathered the papers up, he felt the positive Jackman return. Come on, he told himself. We're turning the screw. We're making it difficult for anyone to move freely in the town, and that had to include Ashcroft. And there would be no let-up. When Ruth was told of Sam's injuries, still more troops would be drafted into Salton-le-Fen, he was sure.
If he and Marie really were the objects of Ashcroft's attention and were going nowhere, then Ashcroft would be forced to remain too and suffer the consequences of trying to work in a town that looked as if martial law had been declared.
Good, murmured Jackman out loud. Now you feel the heat for a change, Alistair Ashcroft.
In fact, Alistair Ashcroft was feeling very pleased at how things had turned out. His little experiment had worked far better than even he had anticipated. Almost from the beginning, he had singled out Paul from the other Lorimer boys, and if Paul had not come looking for him, he would have gone to him. He had an important role for the youngster. Ashcroft was no fool. He could see it was becoming increasingly difficult to operate freely in Sultan, but it didn't matter. He was tiring of this game. It was so one-sided. He'd expected more of the Fenland Constabulary's finest. He had stayed awake into the early hours of the morning, trying to analyze why he felt the way he did, and had come to no conclusion. After all, this was no crusade, fueled by a deep longing to right a wrong like last time. The satisfaction each death had brought him then seemed hard to replicate this time around. Something was lacking. Maybe it was time to move on. He would get rid of his two pathetic opponents and disappear. Now he had Paul Lorimer to do his bidding. Everything was in place. He could bring it all to a close, today, if he wanted, or tomorrow at the latest. He was a patient man, but the waiting was over. This was Jackman and Marie's last 24 hours. Paul, my friend, when you have finished eating, I'm going to lay out our plan of action, and we'll see what you think of it.
Rachel Lorimer sounded both relieved and angry. Paul's safe, Marie. He phoned us. He's in Greenborough. He went on a bender and has apparently been sleeping it off in some bedsit belonging to someone he knows from work. He's coming home as soon as he's got the alcohol out of his system and is fit to drive.
For some reason, Marie wasn't totally convinced. Did you ask him about the gun?
He said that Jacob is telling fairy stories. He admits he did say he would kill the fake Ezra if he found him, but he never had a gun. He told me to tell Jacob to stop fibbing and getting him into trouble. I told him he didn't need Jacob. He had gotten himself into quite enough trouble, all on his own.
Rachel seemed content with Paul's explanation, but Marie's doubts remained. When he gets home, please ring me. I'd like to talk to him, okay?
Of course, and I'm sorry to have caused a lot of fuss for nothing.
We were as worried as you, Rachel. I'm just pleased that you've heard from him. Did he sound okay, other than the hangover?
Absolutely fine. He said he was sorry. He's not used to strong alcohol. He pretty well never drinks, so I think it hit him hard. Serves him right, young fool. I won't let him forget this in a hurry, believe me.
Rachel hung up, leaving Marie undecided whether to breathe a sigh of relief or worry even more. She went to see if Jackman was back from the super's office. She found him in the corridor talking to Robbie and Max. She immediately knew from their faces that something was wrong. She hurried towards them, almost frightened to ask what it was. Jackman's expression was grim.
Laura just rang me. Sam's taken a turn for the worst. Ruth Crook is on her way to the hospital now. He has no family, and he's been a huge help to us in the past, so she thought it was appropriate.
Do you want to go? Marie asked immediately. You must want to be with Laura.
She's going to text me if his condition deteriorates further. Meanwhile, we have a possible lead to Ashcroft. Robbie and Max are just heading out to see if it's viable.
It sounds kosher, Sarge. Where we're going is only 20 miles from here, so we'll report in as soon as, okay?
Max said. It was good to hear his familiar Cockney voice again.
She watched them hurry off. I've just heard from Rachel Lorimer, sir. She says Paul rang her. Apparently he got hammered and had been sleeping it off at a mate's house in Greenborough.
One less problem to worry about, Jackman said.
If it's true, she retorted.
You think otherwise, Marie?
She frowned. It doesn't quite fit with what we know about Paul Lorimer, sir. like the fact that he rarely drinks. And how did he get to Greenborough if he was drunk?
Anyone can drown their sorrows if they're upset or pissed off enough. And if he doesn't drink much, well, it would hit him like a runaway train. He looked at her thoughtfully. Maybe his mate drove his car there for him, who knows? Or maybe he went straight to Greenborough when he couldn't find Ashcroft here.
I know I've told myself all that, but it still niggles. I can't see him giving up that easily if he was seeing red over the fake Ezra.
I see. Well, I know those niggles of yours, so if you're having one now, keep in touch with Rachel Lorimer until you know he's actually home and safe.
I've already planned to do that, Murray shrugged. I'm probably fretting over nothing, but I won't be happy until I see or talk to him myself.
She gathered her thoughts.
So, what's this lead?
On their way to his office, Jackman said, There's another thing we have to thank Kenneth Harcourt for. He's been talking to two other gun clubs, both of whom conduct sniper experience days, and one of them put him onto their firearms training officer, who's ex-army. Harcourt asked him if he'd had anyone on a course in the last few months who had been a cause for concern in any way. The guy said not especially, but did get back to Harcourt a bit later, saying that there was one man that he had found a bit disturbing. They went into Jackman's office. And the man in question is the one from whom his driving license photo resembles Ashcroft. Jackman picked up a scribbled memo. Listen to this. This particular guy was intense, really so. Most applicants for this course are armchair heroes acting out some video game. Some are adrenaline junkies, some want to go a step further than paintball, and others want a taste of army life to see if it's for them. This guy didn't fit into any category I've ever come across before. Jackman looked up. It sounded worth sending Rob and Charlie to ask a few more questions.
I'll see. I look forward to their call.
Her face fell.
But I'm not looking forward to a call from Greenborough Hospital. Are you sure you don't want to go, boss? I can hold the fort here.
Thanks, Marie. But with the super off-site, I'll hang on a bit longer. I'll ring Laura shortly and keep you posted on how Sam's doing. Meanwhile, I suggest we just keep busy. Marie returned to her desk. She wanted to ask forensics if they had found any interesting evidence on the jacket that she had pulled off the little scroat who placed a wreath on her motorbike.
Ah, telepathy, I was about to ring you, dear heart, Rory said. Although, naught about that rather manky jacket. Now, let me see, it's here somewhere.
Marie could hear him rummaging through papers.
Here we are, said Rory. There was nothing of significance that could lead to identifying the owner, but there was an inordinate amount of animal fur, hair, and other assorted detritus on it. I'm not talking about a moggy or a pet pooch here. This was sheep's wool, cow, donkey, and pig hairs, apart from a hefty dose of chicken shit. A regular young farmer he was.
One of the Lorimers, murmured Marie. It has to be.
In retrospect, the more she thought about the retreating figure that she had pursued down her road, the more she believed it could have been Noah.
If only she had seen his face.
She'd seen one of those jackets in his caravan, but it could have belonged to Jacob. Not that it really mattered anymore. Ashcroft had moved on considerably since then.
Thanks, Rory. So, what were you going to ring me about?
Well, we found the bullet that killed your colleague, Ernie Teal, buried deep in his brain, and although my talented young Spike told you it was doubtful that he would be able to identify the gun, the dear boy underestimated his own talents. It was an S&W 500 cartridge. You are almost certainly looking for a Smith & Wesson Model 500, one of the most powerful handguns in the world, and most definitely capable of killing with a single shot. It has as much firepower as a rifle.
Marie groaned.
Just what I needed to hear, Rory. Bad enough having a psycho wandering the streets, but with one of those tucked in his underpants, doesn't bear thinking about.
Well, I for one can think of better things to keep in one's boxers, Rory giggled.
Laughing, Marie thanked him and hung up. Where had Ashcroft got a revolver like that? Since talking to Kenneth Harcourt, she had a new appreciation of the financial value of weapons. She stood up. She had better pass this on to Jackman. Then it came to her that she'd forgotten to ring her mother. Marie pulled out her mobile and called Rhiannon. As she waited for her to answer, Marie had a sudden longing to just throw a few things into a bag, fill up the bike and take off for Wales. The thought of the solitude of the mountains brought a lump to her throat.
"Sorry, darling, I'm doing the prescription run for the Wrinkleys this morning and the signal's bad in this place."
Her mother's voice came and went with the poor signal strength.
"I'll find a better spot and ring you back."
A few moments later, she was back on the line.
"Better?
I'm in between the two valleys and it's usually okay here."
"Much better, Mum.
I just wanted you to know that I'm all right. Just overworked and it was too late to ring last night."
"It's never too late. But I know how busy you are."
There was a pause, and her mother said,
"You have no idea how much I worry about you, Marie. There was a breaking news flash on the BBC earlier. It said a police officer had been killed in Lincolnshire. It was your killer's handiwork, wasn't it?"
"You know I can't say. But as you are rarely wrong about anything..."
"Was he a colleague?"
"I hardly knew him. But it makes no difference. He was one of us, and the whole force is hurting.
This might sound hard, my darling, but don't let it distract you or make you angry. Keep a cool head and think clearly. You're a fine detective, so don't let this evil man make you emotional, because I'm sure that's his plan."
"Oh, yes, Mum. He knows how to cause chaos, all right." She thought of Sam Page, another innocent victim hanging somewhere between life and death. It was all collateral damage to Ashcroft.
"If only it were possible, I would drive right now to your misty fens, gather you up and bring you home."
Her mum had a catch in her voice.
"There's nothing I would rather do, that's the truth, Mum."
They both sighed.
"But that won't happen,"
her mother said. She lowered her voice.
"I'll be praying for you, for all of you. Try to stay safe, my angel, and look after that lovely Jackman."
"Oh yes, I'll do that, I promise." After a few more comforting words, Marie ended the call, promising herself that as soon as this was over, she would take some leave and bugger off to Wales. She was already making plans for the care of her cat when she heard Jackman calling. "Got 5 minutes, Marie."
"On my way. Shall I bring coffee?"
"Mind reader." Jackman looked a lot less somber. "Sam's out of the woods. He's still being monitored very carefully, but the crisis has passed. Laura said that barring anything unforeseen, he'll pull through." Jackman looked almost elated. "You know, I had no idea just how much Laura thought of that old chap. She was totally grief-stricken, and he was standing right next to her. It was bad enough for us, but Laura's not law enforcement. She'd never experienced anything like it before. Anyway, she's over the moon that he's recovering now, and I've got D.I. Nicky Galena's troops keeping a close eye on her, as well as Sam."
"Smart move, sir."
She told him about what Rory had said, and about the handgun. "I really do not like all this weaponry he's got hold of." Jackman's face creased into a frown. "I just pray that Ashcroft doesn't have some kind of major finale planned."
"Like a mass shooting?"
asked Marie. She imagined shopping centres, fleeing crowds. Jackman just nodded. "Except that he'd know it would mean his own death. Our tactical units would take him out, no question."
"And he did say it would come down to the three of us in the end, didn't he?"
Marie said. Jackman's desk phone rang. Max's Cockney accent filled the room. Jackman had switched on loudspeaker.
"Quick update, boss. This is good, better than we hoped for. That training officer has fingered Ashcroft for certain. He's coming back with us to make a full statement. Rob and me thought you'd like to hear what he has to say, but right now we're checking another bit of interesting info."
Jackman glanced at Marie, whispering,
"Better and better.
The security here is tight as a duck's backside, and I don't reckon matey boy Ashcroft was aware of exactly how tight it was. They have hidden cameras all over the shop, and our firearms officer here, whose name is Nicholas Benfield, reckons he's got some really tasty snaps of our Alistair." He paused. "And his car." Marie leant forward. Can't wait to meet this man, said Jackman, and see his rogues gallery. As soon as we've gathered everything up, we'll be on our way, boss. See you travelling time plus 20. Jackman hung up. We're inching ever closer, aren't we? By strength and guile, we'll get him. Now, where did that come from?
It's the motto for the Special Boat Services, the Special Forces unit that Barney, a.k.a. Arthur Barnes, belonged to, Jackman said.
Well, it seemed fitting. This is one interview I do not want to miss.
Neither shall you, Jackman smiled. Thank heavens this gun club is not too far away. I can't wait to get this man's opinion of Ashcroft's skill as a sniper. Can you?
Can I ever? Well done. I'm proud of you.
Ashcroft nodded.
Beautifully executed, and the perfect precursor to your next performance.
Paul looked at him blankly.
Long words and me don't get on, Mr. Renwick. Best stick to the short ones.
Call me Ralphie, Paul. All my friends do, except for poor Ezra. He called me Toff, because he said I was posh and loaded.
If you're that rich, why didn't you bail Uncle Ezra out when he got tied up with these bad people?
Ventured Paul.
Because the kind of debt he ran up was beyond even me.
Ashcroft's tone was one of sadness and regret. It was tiring, really. Even for this little beetle-brained idiot, he needed to put on a convincing performance.
I'm well off, I agree, but not as loaded as your uncle believed. I would have moved heaven and earth for Ezra, and it hurts me every day to know that I failed him, but...
He raised his hands.
What could I do?
He sighed loudly, then allowed his smile to slowly return.
But back to you, Paul. You did well, very well. Now, we need to practice your next call.
He paused.
This is the one that will earn you some serious money, my young friend.
The young man stared at him, a look of deep concentration on his worried face.
Tell me again, Mr. Renwick, Ralphie, why I'm doing this, apart from the money.
Somehow Ashcroft maintained that smile.
God, this idiot was trying even his patience. Of course, Paul. It's important that you fully understand.
He took a deep breath.
I'm a wanted man. The police now know that I'm not Ezra, but they believe that I killed him and took his place. Even worse, they think I'm this maniac who is going around shooting people. So even though I am completely innocent, I'm wanted for murder.
He stared hard at Paul.
I've taken a huge risk by staying to try and sort this out. I could have just fled, couldn't I?
Paul nodded slowly.
Yes. Yes, you could.
Exactly. But I didn't.
Mainly because I've become very attached to you and your family. And I also wanted to stop these terrible shootings and clear my name. The police have no idea who I am or what I look like. I certainly don't look like the man you thought was Ezra, do I?
Paul grinned.
No way.
So you see, I could easily have run away. Now, the fact is, I can't just go to the police. If I walk into that police station, I will never come out. They will never believe me. Meaning, I need a way to talk privately to D.I. Jackman and D.S. Evans. They seem to be the only ones who might listen to me. But I dare not take the chance of ringing them and suggesting we meet.
He looked at Paul.
Are you with me so far?
Paul nodded.
Man to man, Paul. You've met them and talked to them. I trust your judgment. They are decent people, aren't they?
After a while, Paul nodded again.
Yes, I think they're straight. They care about Ma, and they were good with us, considering the trouble you got us into.
There was a slight accusatory edge to his words. Something I will always bitterly regret. But regarding the present situation, you will help me? I'm innocent, Paul, and as I told you before, my last hope is to convince Jackman and Evans of this. I need to get them on their own, away from all those other police officers, and I need your help to make that happen. There is no other way.
One phone call, one trip out with you, and then I go home.
With enough money in your pocket to feed your family for a year.
Solemnly, Paul held out his hand to Alistair Ashcroft.
Deal.
An hour and a half later, Paul Lorimer sat alone in the big old house, fingering the £50 notes in his pocket and wondering what to do. He had a full stomach, had been out with Renwick to visit the place he'd chosen for his rendezvous with the two detectives, and now, if he wanted, he could up and run. He wasn't locked in. Renwick trusted him. He would be out for several hours, he said, so Paul was to watch television and relax. They would run through the second phone call he was to make, and as soon as the meeting was over, he would be free to go home with the rest of the money. One more call, one small job, and that would be the end of it. For the 20th time, Paul took out the money and stared at it. Even this was more than he'd ever had before, but Renwick had said there was more to come. No, it was worth waiting. Still, he was anxious. The biggest problem was getting this next bit right. He knew what he was like. If the smallest thing went wrong, his temper would flare up and he would lose it. And then he'd lose everything. Chapter 30. Even if he hadn't been wearing camouflage pants and a khaki t-shirt, Nick Benfield couldn't have been anything other than army. He was tall, muscular, and clearly worked out a lot. His fair hair was cut close to the scalp, and he had what Jackman could only think of as a tough, weathered baby face.
If it's all right with you, we'll do this in an interview room and take what you have to say. It'll make life easier for us, should what you have to say turn out to be admissible evidence.
Without waiting for an answer, Jackman led the way to interview room 4, followed by Benfield and an excited Marie. Introductions over with, Jackman said,
"Can you tell us everything you know about this man?"
He pointed to a photo that lay on the table, one of Orak's better representations of Alistair Ashcroft.
"For the tape, I am showing Mr. Benfield a likeness of Alistair Ashcroft."
"The name I knew him by was Gavin Archer. He became a regular visitor to the gun club around 2 months ago. After about 3 weeks, he signed up for the sniper experience."
Nick briefly paused.
"As I told the other detectives, he was different to most of the people we get on that particular course. He was, well, so into it. He was intense about absolutely everything. For most participants, it's a fun experience, bit of excitement, playing at being a fighting soldier for a day. Not so with Gavin. No fun there. He made every aspect of it a deeply serious undertaking. I was very uncomfortable teaching him, D.I. Jackman. I have had 1,000 squaddies pass through my training sessions, some of them real tough cookies. There's been a few weirdos too, but no one made me feel like Gavin Archer did. It takes a lot to ruffle me, but he managed it, and how."
"What sort of shot was he, Nick?" asked Marie.
"First class. One of the best novices I've had on the range. Guy was a natural. You'd only have to tell him something once. When he first started, he said he was worried about eye dominance. Now, most beginners haven't even heard of that, let alone its possible effects on the shot. He was such an eager student. I should have liked him, but I didn't.
From what you say, it appears he did have some knowledge of guns, even though you say he was a beginner," Jackman said.
"I'd say so, yes.
We believe that prior to joining your club, he was a member of the Fenside Gun Club here in Salton. Would that seem right to you?"
Nick nodded.
"We would answer several questions about his ability. And Harcourt's club is a good one. I spent some time there years back. He has a good crew."
"You heard that the armourer was shot and killed?" Marie asked.
Nick looked angry.
"I did, and ever since I have been asking myself whether I trained the man who pulled the trigger on Arthur Barnes and those other men."
Jackman said,
"If he hadn't gone to you, he would have gone somewhere else. You have no reason to blame yourself at all. He was a killer with a plan. He used you and your club like he's used so many others.
The main thing is that you could be instrumental in us catching him. You have given us new, up-to-date footage of him, and you've provided us with a vehicle registration number. Robbie and Max are checking that out right now. That's a big thing, Nick. Nick Benfield didn't look totally appeased by Jackman's words.
Training soldiers, getting them ready for battle is one thing. Teaching some psycho the tricks of the trade is another. It makes you sick to your stomach.
That was how Ashcroft worked. Using and manipulating people to get what he wanted.
Listen. Nick Benfield leaned forward across the table. I'm not sure if this will help, but the man I knew as Archer became close buddies with another club member. I'm pretty sure they met up outside the club, but I certainly saw them in the cafe together several times. Thing is, this other man, his name is Larry Turner, by the way, is not only a gun collector. He's in one of your tactical firearms teams.
He's a copper, Marie said, horrified.
And a pretty obsessive collector of small arms. I heard he owns around 30 or more weapons.
Nick looked from one to the other.
He's a nice bloke. I always liked him. So I couldn't see why he was so pally with Archer.
Because that's what Archer, or Ashcroft as he really is, wanted. Police officer or not, Ashcroft charmed him.
Jackman wrote down the name. Is he still a serving officer, Nick?
I think so. He hasn't been to the club for a while, but I can get you his address if that'd help.
Marie stood up.
It's okay. I'll get someone to run it through our computer right now.
She went to the door, called to a constable and gave him the name. Jackman's mind was doing overtime.
A police marksman.
What better choice for a buddy? How long had Ashcroft been planning this? And was it all just to get back at Marie and him? It was beyond reason.
There's one more thing, Inspector.
Nick's voice tore him from his reverie.
At the same time as Archer, or whoever he is, was with us, a handgun was stolen. We had a good idea who had taken it, but we had no proof. We'd had a bit of trouble with a young chap who was a right big mouth. He'd been given a 2-day ticket for the sniper experience, won it in a competition or something like that. But he was disruptive, and we asked him to leave after the first day. He raised Cain, and I threw him out. Afterwards, we discovered a gun had gone missing. We assumed it was him, but maybe...
Maybe someone else took advantage of the furore, Marie said.
Could be.
Nick, was it a Smith & Wesson Model 500 revolver? Jackman asked.
How the hell...
Jackman and Marie shared a glance.
Now we know where he got it, Jackman said.
He returned his gaze to Nick Benfield.
Ashcroft stole it, not your young troublemaker.
That's a mighty powerful weapon.
We know. It's already killed a police officer, murmured Marie.
Jesus, Nick whistled softly.
What is this guy?
He's a master deceiver, Nick, Jackman said. Hell-bent on destruction.
One last question. I know this may sound odd, but did you ever notice him wearing a particular cologne?
Yeah, I did, as a matter of fact. Most guys doing these courses finish up all sweaty, but this Archer always smelt good.
Thanks for that. You've just confirmed another link. Jackman stopped the tape and stood up.
Your help has been really invaluable. If you think of anything else, here's my card.
Did you come in with Robbie and Max, or did you bring your own car?
I came in with your detectives.
Then we'll get you a car to take you back. Jackman held out his hand.
Thank you, again. It's very much appreciated.
While Marie organized transport for Nick Benfield, Jackman hurried back upstairs to the CID room.
Boss, we're on the right track.
Max looked as if he was on something.
We reckon he's still using the same car as when he was posing as Gavin Archer. Oh, and the real Archer is a long-term patient in the Grange nursing home in Fenchester. He was mugged and sustained a head injury that left him on life support for a while. He's a single man with no relatives, debilitating brain damage and no recollection of the mugging. Now, although it was thought nothing was stolen in the attack, I suspect his driving license was nicked and Ashcroft used it as an ID to get him into the gun club.
Robbie hurried over to join them. He too was barely able to curb his excitement.
We've just picked up the car being used a few days ago in the Calder Road area. We lost it when it went off around the back doubles, but we have civilians checking the data from all the ANPR cameras coming into and going out of Salton. If we can pinpoint a road or location he uses regularly, we can concentrate our search in that area.
Good work. Maybe the tide is turning for us.
The two young detectives went back to their desks, while Jackman returned to his office to look at the CCTV footage that Nick Benfield had made available from the sniper course. He saw at once that the man calling himself Gavin Archer was Ashcroft. When Marie joined him, Jackman was watching a separate film, one made to advertise the courses. Ashcroft, unaware of being filmed, was lying stretched out full length in long grass, wearing a black polo top and black cargo pants, his sniper rifle on a tripod and pointing to a target that was so far away it was almost out of sight.
"Now that is called focus," muttered Marie, seeing the look of total concentration on his face.
"Remember what his old teacher said about him during the last case? Even as a boy, Ashcroft could do anything he put his mind to, and excel at it." He gave a short laugh. "Although I suspect being a serial killer wasn't something the teacher had in mind."
Marie sat down. "I just saw the super's car fighting its way through the press cameras by the car park."
"Well, I'd better bring her up to speed. At least we have something positive for once."
Just as he was about to leave, Max appeared at his door.
"Boss, we've got a bit of a problem with the police firearms chap Larry Turner."
"Come in, Max."
Jackman returned to his desk.
"Problem?"
"Thing is, he's been on sick leave for quite a few weeks now. Stress, they say. And because of his job, he's been rested."
Max looked at his pocketbook.
"Welfare did a domiciliary visit recently, and he wouldn't even let him in. He called out that he was really poorly and that his sister was coming to collect him and take him back with her to Weymouth."
"Is this going where I think it is?" asked Jackman.
"Probably. HR has no contact address for his sister, and now he's off the radar."
Jackman swore under his breath.
"Where does this guy live?"
"Hartley O'Dyke, 3 miles outside Salton. Small house on the main road into the village. It's called Snipe Dale."
"Most appropriate, I'm sure. Fancy a ride, Max? And you, Marie?"
They stood up.
"Aren't you coming, boss?" Marie asked.
He shook his head.
"I'd better report into Ruth. But ring me if you find anything of interest, okay?"
Marie gave a little salute.
"Will do.
Go on, grab a vehicle, Max. I'll be right with you."
"On my way, Sarge."
He turned in the doorway and grinned at her.
"I'm glad to be back."
"We are too, mate. Now bugger off and get that car."
Needing to get away from his idiot acolyte, Ashcroft found a small cafe in Salton's only shopping precinct, from where he watched the police moving to and fro. How he hated that boy Paul and his evil temper, stupidity and childishness. He hated having to go over every single thing again and again before it sank in. Ashcroft stared into his cup. This whole business had become tiresome. Why, even his old nemesis had disappointed him.
He had expected so much more of their game. Twists and turns and hair-raising moments.
But there had been no reaction at all from them. He needed a new challenge, because clearly Jackman wasn't up to it. He drank his insipid coffee, wondering where it had all gone wrong. His expectations had clearly been too high. Best to end it and start afresh elsewhere. It would not be the epic conclusion he had been looking forward to, but it would be satisfying enough. Then he'd move on. He downed the rest of his drink and stood up. It hadn't been all bad. In fact, the journey had been edifying and rather enjoyable.
His new skill with deadly weapons gave him a massive advantage, and he had confirmed his talent as a chameleon. If nothing else, it had shown him that there was nothing in this world he couldn't do. So what next? He left the cafe, strode back to the car park. Time to dispense with Jackman and his Marie, and kiss goodbye to Sultan Le Fen. Chapter 31. Larry Turner's house looked neglected, uncared for. Weeds were fast overtaking the plants in the front garden, and the small lawn was long overdue for a cut. Marie had a bad feeling about it.
"I get the feeling we're going to draw a blank, don't you, Sarge?"
Max said.
"Doesn't look the kind of place where someone would keep a valuable gun collection, does it?"
Marie agreed. It was a small, old-style, semi-detached house just off the main road into Hartley O'Dyke. With a little more care, it could have been as attractive as the adjoining house, which certainly put Larry Turner's to shame. Max rang the doorbell and waited. After a while, he bent down and looked through the letterbox, then turned to Marie.
"There's been some kind of disturbance. Stuff all over the floor and a broken table lamp. I'll go round the back."
Marie ran around the side of the house, through a low gate and into the back garden. She tried the back door and the French windows, but all were locked. She peered in, but could see no further signs of anything being amiss. She glanced up to the bedroom windows and saw that one was slightly ajar. No way could she get inside that way. Then she noticed a shadowy figure behind the curtains of the house next door.
"It's okay. We're the police,"
she called out, and held up her warrant card.
"Could you come out and talk to us, please?"
A few moments later, an elderly lady stood on the other side of the fence.
"Can I see that warrant card properly? And what do you want?"
The accent was a local one, and she was obviously not a trusting sort of person. In fact, she looked downright hostile.
"I'm Detective Sergeant Marie Evans. My colleague DC Max Cohen and I are trying to find Mr. Turner."
"Haven't seen him in weeks, and not a word to me to say he was going anywhere."
The old lady looked put out.
"I know he's been poorly, but there are such things as good manners, and he promised to feed my Henry this week so I could have a few days with my sister in Skeggy. Had to cancel, and she ain't best pleased."
"Oh dear, I'm sorry to hear that. I suppose you don't hold a key for him, do you?"
Marie asked.
"Oh, no. We gets along fine, but he's a private man, and he wouldn't go handing keys out. Says he's got things in the house that's under lock and key, and it's best they stays that way. Things to do with his work with you lot, I suppose."
"Probably," said Marie vaguely.
"You didn't hear anything like the sound of a fight before he went, did you?" The woman shook her head.
"No. But I does have me TV up loud, on account of my hearing aid playing up. Anyway, he was a quiet man. I've never heard no raised voices, even when he had his friend around."
"His friend?"
"Tall, well-spoken man used to call recently. Very polite, he were. Said he went target shooting with Larry."
Marie pulled a copy of the